Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 164, The Buddha's Entourage.
Okay, so therefore I see Buddha as a scientist coming up with. And therefore, that makes this era of ours really positive, because we have had the Copenhagen Declaration, and although our scientists are loath to face that fact, their minds have come back into being part of nature automatically by matter disappearing, and they have the theoretical humility by some of their leading physicists to say that we were not going to capture reality in our theories, in our mathematics, and we're not going to be the high priests of a new permanent, religion, which the materialists sort of reductionizing everything and controlling it all, We're not going to do that. Which the British, like someone like Bertrand Russell, Principia Mathematica, he thought he was following on Newton, and he was going to come up with a perfect theoretical notation to fit with the absolute simple elements of reality, material reality, perfectly adapting and fitting to them, so that then finally philosophy / science would have control, theoretical control of the nature of reality. And Wittgenstein sort of did him one better at first, and then dumped the whole enterprise. Which I love that, actually. Because actually, the sutra that we're going to look at now is a secular document, actually. Although, but maybe by the time it was written as a document, it's no longer secular. I have to acknowledge that. By the time the Sri Lankans wrote it down, about 7-8 centuries after the Buddha taught, and then we think, well, then it couldn't resemble what he actually said in any way. It must have been changed totally over so long. But that's partly because we don't understand the memory, the mnemonic ability of the Indian civilization in those days. I have a former graduate student of mine, PhD graduate of mine, who had trouble getting a job as a Hindu or Buddhist studies or Sanskritist, because there's not many such jobs in academia, in Western academia. So he went back and got another PhD in neuroscience in Italy, and had a nice diet while he was getting it, and then went and studied Vedic chanters and priests today in India. And they have a brain, their memory area in the brain is like the London taxi driver. It's unique. It has a gigantic storage that accurately stores these Vedic hymns that they recite and chant in the rituals. Thousands of pages of them, amazingly. And although actually the only thing close to it that they have on neuroscientific record are London taxi drivers, the old London taxi drivers. I don't know if the new ones have to pass the test of every little alley and weird thing in London, but the old ones were able to do that. So now, the Samana, so therefore, although this was written in the Pali language in Sri Lanka, many, many centuries after the Buddha's time, and the monks had a system, the mendicants had a system in the many, many thousands of Buddhist monasteries all over India and Sri Lanka by that time, where a certain number of monks knew a certain number of these suttas, these teachings verbally given by Buddha, because he didn't write anything down. He made one drawing, but he didn't write anything down once he was enlightened. But when they would get old, they would have several disciples who would then he would transmit the memorization to. would memorize. And the fact that they kept them very pristinely that way is very, very possible, actually. So, you know, modern scholars like to have this thing of, well, the real Buddha, nobody knows, maybe he never existed. And actually, the Buddhists themselves were asking that question only 300 or 400 years. There's a book called The Questions of King Milinda in English, where the monk Nagasena, the Greco-Bactrian king of a certain principality in Pakistan, who talking to a Buddhist monk in the 3rd century before the Common Era, or 2nd or 3rd century before the Common Era, asked Nagasena, since he never met the Buddha personally, could he allow for the possibility that maybe Buddha never existed? And Nagasena saying, yeah, that's possible. Maybe it's just a group delusion that I've inherited. But then he had a counter argument, because the teaching is so amazing, it must have come from a certain source. So the Buddhists were already thinking about maybe there was never such a thing as the Buddha themselves, and rejecting that idea. Because when you read this, you kind of enter Buddha's mind, actually. And that's what we're going to do. Okay? Now, Samanapala Sutta means, he translated fruits of the homeless life. This particular translator, which is a good, reasonable translation. Sutta could mean, you know, a discourse. In Buddhism, it means a discourse by the Buddha. You know, where it's more or less, although it has some description of how, where it happened, connected it to it. So it's not only his speech, you know, is it about where it happened and who he talked to and so on. But the main point of it is what he said. And pala means fruit or effect, cause and effect, effect. But samana does have a homeless life. A shamana means someone who, a seeker is what it means. The life of a seeker. But in that day in India, the Indian economy and society was so wealthy and so generous that all you had to do was sort of convince people that you were a seeker of truth and you had a lifelong scholarship from the whole society. You didn't have to have a paper, you didn't have to apply, you just stopped working, stopped service in the army, maybe you had to have permission from your family in some late after a while, and you were supported for lifelong study and meditation by the whole society with an infinite free lunch. Exactly what we don't have in America. There would be a free lunch provided to you by the kings, by the priests. The priests were a little upset about it, but oh yeah. But Buddha was very careful with those mendicants who created this community not to do anything that the priests did, not to do anything religious. In other words, the Buddhist mendicants were prohibited from performing naming ceremonies, marriage ceremonies, divination ceremonies, funerals. They were prohibited from doing any of those things, which was the livelihood of the Brahmins, the priests, which is why Buddha was not crucified, you know, or like strung up or something, because he was leaving them with their livelihood, those priests. Later on, when it became highly established, then Buddhist monks did begin to serve like as priests here and there. But for centuries, they did not. And still, a monk technically is forbidden from doing that. And so when they have their bi-monthly meetings, twice a month meetings, if that's what bi-monthly means, twice a month meetings to cleanse themselves of their infractions, the monks, they, you know, well, I performed a wedding, I'm sorry, you know. I let that couple get into the misery of samsara even deeper by having a marriage relationship. And they apologize to the other monks, and then they're given like so many Hail Marys, you know, so many Om Mani Padme Hum to recite. So now that's what a shamana is. So now this sutta is very important one, they consider it, because it's requoted in many other sutras, so it's a good one. Now first, that's what I heard once. It's a mistranslation to I think. I argue, to say once the Lord. It should say, thus have I heard, or really, thus did I hear once, or at one time, it should say. Why? Evam maya shrutam ekasmin samaye, and the Pali equivalent of that. What that means is, that's the signature of authenticity, because one of Buddha's cousins, I think, Ananda was his name, became a great enlightened arhat, but not during Buddha's lifetime. He so faithfully served the Buddha as his kind of attendant once he became a mendicant that he sort of never had time to really realize the Buddha's teaching. But he was an idiot savant. He had a savant quality. He could remember everything that you said. For 2 hours, he would repeat to you. And he had all of Buddha's statements by heart, supposedly. So when Buddha died, he was the next successor who Buddha designated as the leader of the mendicant community by that time, which was quite large, Mahakasyapa, or Mahakasapa in Pali, kicked Ananda out. And he said, you have to leave the community because you didn't ask Buddha to live forever. One time Buddha said, you know, Buddha can live as long as he likes, and you didn't ask him. So then he died at 80, and we're upset about it. And I don't even want to, I'm almost the same age as Buddha, I don't want to lead this community, so, and you let us down, so you're out. So then Ananda was no longer a mendicant, and he was like, well, bereft, and Buddha had died. So he immediately went into Samadhi under a tree somewhere and retained arhatship. So then naturally they let him back. They were only like putting him out so that he wasn't depending on anybody and he would have to think it through, you know, and he would have to contemplate it and have to realize. And then he became a great leader of the community, actually, himself, much longer, because he was younger, much longer than Mahakasapa. He became the second great leader, Ananda. So it should be, thus did I hear at one time. On a certain occasion, period. Meaning, Ananda is the one reciting this. Therefore, the Buddha really did say this. That's what it means. The Westerners translate it like that because they don't believe in the whole thing. They don't think there's any such thing as enlightenment. And they're doing once upon a time. It's a fairy tale for them. It's very rude, actually. This does have been once. I even had... Never mind, I won't go into that. Okay, thus have I heard at one time. Thus did I hear at a certain occasion. And what was the certain occasion? Well, the Lord was staying at Rajagriha, the capital of the Magadha kingdom, in Jivaka Kumara Bacha's mango grove. Jivaka was a famous doctor in Buddha's time. And there's a history about the characters in here, which I will tell you. And so he was staying there. In other words, the other thing that the early mendicants didn't have is they didn't have fixed abodes, fixed habitations. But they had different groves they were given. And then when the rains came, they would make little huts for them or some shelters and things. And these gradually became what we might think of as monasteries. But initially, there were so much seekers, and they only ate before noon, so they would not sleep heavily, and they would meditate a lot, and study and think and try to figure out the nature of reality, which is what they were doing. And they were together with a large company of some 1,250 mendicants, it should say. Although we call them monks, you know, but it's different than a religious Christian monk. It's a mendicant, the seeker of reality, a shramana. But shramana also means to wander somewhere, a wandering seeker. And at that time, King Ajatashatru, Vedehiputta, Magadha, as he was the king, having gone up to the roof of his palace, was sitting there surrounded by his ministers on the 15th fast day, at the full moon of the fourth month, called Komudi. Oh, really? I never noticed that. That actually is the day of Buddha's enlightenment, usually. The lunar month, it means. Fourth lunar month. And that is always celebrated as Buddha's birth in the Indian and Tibetan tradition, at least, the Mahayana tradition. Birth, enlightenment, and death, parinirvana, a withdrawal from his ordinary body. So it was a very auspicious day. Now, that king, Ajatashatru, was a patricide and a matricide and a regicide. He was an arch criminal. He killed his father and mother, and of course the father was the king, and so he killed his king because he was misled by Buddha's half-brother called Devadatta, who was like the Judas of the Buddha story. A very bad guy. And by this time, this is later in Buddha's life that Ajatashatru is the king again, you know. And later in his life, and so this guy himself tried to kill the Buddha in company as well. He tried to kill the Buddha as well unleashing a crazed elephant where the Buddha was walking to as a mendicant in his city. And he conspired with the Buddha's half-brother to release an elephant to trample him. But when the elephant came up to Buddha, the elephant thought he met his mother or something, and so he just calmed down. Buddha patted him, nice elephant. So they didn't get to kill him, but he tried. So this Ajatasattu was a really ugly customer, in short. And it's a long story about the thing, but he was misled by Buddha's half-brother. Although, just to introduce a different note, that half-brother in the Mahayana is said to have been Buddha's first person in a previous life who taught him the Lotus Sutra. And it's actually a Bodhisattva who's being the bad guy in the Buddha story to show the Buddha how he reacts to a super bad guy. But that's the Mahayana, and that we'll get to later. But I can't resist putting that in. Anyway, it's the bad guy. So he's thinking, well, what shall we do, delightful friends? And King Ajatashatru, on that fast day, gave vent to this solemn utterance. Delightful friends is this moonlight night. Charming is this moonlight night. Auspicious is this moonlight night. Can we not today visit some ascetic, that's a shramana, he's translating, a seeker it should be, or priest, seeker or priest. You know, Brahman means a priest, you know, like one who does rituals. Seeker is one who meditates and seeks the nature of reality. Some seeker or some mendicant or Brahman to visit whom would bring peace to our heart. Now, his heart is not peaceful because he killed his father, mother, and tried to kill the Buddha. But he's forgotten about that, sort of. But he doesn't ask to see Buddha. He just some ascetic or Brahman. You know? So then they list six people that they suggest that he, different ministers suggest that he goes to, six teachers. One of them actually supposedly is Mahavira, founder of Jainism. So he a little bit, in the Pali literature, he has a little bit, has a certain negative, slightly negative role. Anyway, there are six of them, and King Ajatasattu doesn't respond to their suggestions. And we'll find out later why in the sutta. But by not responding, he's not agreeing to follow their suggestion. So he just was silent, means he doesn't want to go there and see that one. Okay? So then finally, at this all this time, Jivaka, that's the doctor, the royal doctor, and a great surgeon actually, supposedly, did brain surgery in some stories, was sitting silently near King Ajatasattu. And the king said to him, "You friend Jivaka, why are you silent?" So then Jivaka answers, "Sire, there is this blessed Lord, Bhagavan," that's one name of Buddha, "the Arhat, the fully enlightened Buddha, staying in my mango grove with a large company of some 1,250 monks. And concerning the blessed Gotama," he refers to Buddha as the Shakyamuni as Gotama, this is his family, that's his clan name, "this fair report has been spread about. This Bhagavan..." So the Bhagavan means sort of happy, lucky person. You know, Bhagavan has a lot of meanings, but it means sort of a share, fortune, and just, I can't resist saying, it also happens to mean the vagina as well. So, but Bhagavan is the word they use for God, later Hinduism, and the first use of it that we know of is for Buddha in Buddhism, Bhagavan. So, this blessed Lord, this Bhagavan, is an arhat, a fully enlightened Buddha. Arhat means one who has conquered the enemy of ignorance, so an enlightened person, endowed with wisdom and conduct, wisdom and ethics, better, the welfarer, the happy one, actually. He's not on welfare. He is on welfare, actually, because I told you the whole country gives free lunch to anybody who sincerely is seeking, not to everybody, but just anybody, but to sincerely seeking the nature of reality, you know, a sincere seeker. So he is on welfare anyway, but this sugata doesn't mean welfare, it means sukham gata, it means one who has gone to bliss. So blissful one is what it means properly. Knower of the worlds, knower of the relative world, that is, incomparable teacher of humans to be tamed, tameable humans. And tame is the word they use for educate, actually. I don't like training all the time. Educator of humans, of educable humans. teacher of gods and humans, another name, Deva Manushyanam Shastra, the teacher of humans and gods, both, enlightened and blessed. May your majesty visit the blessed Lord. He may well bring peace to your majesty's heart. And the Jatashatru then works up his courage, because he probably can remember that he tried to kill this particular seeker. But by now, his Buddha has become also very famous and has a large following. So he now agrees. He works up his courage. So he says, then Jivaka, have the riding elephants made ready. He goes on his elephant. Very good, sire, said Jivaka. And he had 500 she-elephants made ready, and for the king, the royal tusker. That's the kind of way they behaved, those Indian kings, supposedly. And so they went, and he brought his 500 wives with him. He really was self-indulgent. And they went there. But now this is very interesting, of course. But when King Ajatasattu came near the mango grove, he felt fear and terror and the rising of the hairs, you know, on the back of his neck. And the king said to Jivaka, friend Jivaka, you're not deceiving me, I hope. You're not tricking me. You're not delivering me up to an enemy. How is it that from this great number of 1,250 mendicants, not a sneeze, a cough, or a shout is to be heard? It's so silent there, you know. But also, unconsciously, he knows he's approaching someone who he tried to kill. And even at an even deeper level, he's entered kind of a closer field of the Buddha. So he's becoming more self-aware, and he's finding deep fear that he carries within him from this really evil thing he did of killing his mother and father, which really stays and haunts somebody, you know, definitely, even though they can live in denial and whatever. And actually, Jivaka did help him in one way. I can say this part of the story. He was going to actually slay the mother with his sword. He was so furious. He had put his father to starve to death in a prison, but the mother visited the father regularly, was allowed visitation, and then used to smear her body with, you know, organic, gluten-free sesame paste and whatever, and he wasn't dying. So then he caught the mother, like, rubbed down with food and honey and stuff. And then he got so angry he was going to kill her physically with a sword. And Jivaka said, no, don't physically do it, that's even worse. At least just enclose her with the father. Because the good doctor couldn't get him to not do it. You know? So now he's feeling terrified, right? Have no fear, your majesty, I would not deceive you or trick you or deliver you up to an enemy. Approach, sire, approach. There are the lights burning in the round pavilion where at this point had been built there, which he Jivaka had built for Buddha, which was his teaching place. So King Ajatasattu, having ridden on his elephant as far as the ground would permit, alighted and continued on foot to the door of the round pavilion. Then he said, Jivaka, where is the Lord, the Bhagavan? And then Jivaka points out a mendicant sitting there. And that is the Lord, sire. That is the Bhagavan sitting against the middle column. So he apparently was not seated on a higher seat, because he couldn't tell which one it was, just against the middle column with his order of monks in front of him. Then King Ajatasattu went up to the Lord and stood to one side, and standing there to one side, the king observed how the order of monks considered in silence like a clear lake. And he exclaimed, talking to himself, if only Prince Udayabandha, that's his son, were possessed of such calm as this order of monks. Do your thoughts go to the one you love, your majesty? The Buddha then addresses him and says, do your thoughts go to the one you love, your majesty? And then, Lord, Prince Udayabada is very dear to me. If only he were possessed of the same calm as this order of monks. And get this, he's killed his own father. So naturally, he's really nervous about his son, subconsciously. But yet he loves him. So Buddha's first thing is point out to him that you love your son, do you? And he involuntarily says, oh, I wish they were as calm and peaceful as all these mendicants. It's really deep. It's just interpersonal. It's not religion. It's not religion. It's secular. Then King Ajatasattu, having bowed down to the Lord and saluted the order of monks with joined hands, sat down to one and said, Lord, I would ask something if the Lord would deign to answer me. Ask your majesty anything you like. And now he asks all these different, you know, professions. And he says, all these people are delighted and pleased with this, you know, the different things they do and the skills they have. You can read yourself all the professions. They themselves, they enjoy here and now the visible fruits of their skills. They themselves are delighted and pleased with this, as are their parents, children, and colleagues and friends. They maintain and support ascetics and priests, like you, thus assuring for themselves a heavenly happy reward tending toward paradise. So he's accepting the social thing, that to support seekers and, of course, priests, that's religious, and seekers are a little different category, but they're kind of making it religious at this point, and they get a good reward for supporting them. Can you, Lord Bhagavan, point to such a reward visible here and now as a fruit of the seeker's life? The Sramanapala.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast was originally broadcast during the Force for Good class series held annually at Tibet House US in New York City. To learn more about the Force for Good class series and to watch past recordings, please visit tibethouse.us. Enjoy video versions of classic episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast, remastered as educational videos available on the Tibet House US YouTube channel. Every like, view, subscription, and comment helps support Tibet House's mission. And now back to Bob in the second half of this week's podcast.
Now Buddha, this is why I love this next. Buddha, instead of answering right away, he says to him, Your Majesty, do you admit that you have put this question to other seekers and priests, you know, ascetics and Brahmins? And I admit it, Lord, and he says, Buddha knows that he did. And it's, would your Majesty mind saying how they replied, the Buddha asks. I do not mind telling the Lord or one like him or anybody else, he's sort of, anybody asks me that, I'll tell them. Well then, Your Majesty, tell me. He goes through six people, which were the same six people earlier that the minister suggested he go see, and he was silent. Remember, he didn't go. Now it turns out he'd already gone to them on other full moons, asked them the question, and then he remembers. It's not stupid. He remembers what they told him, but he said, but each one of them just told him their theory of life, rather than answer his question. So he said, thus, Lord, he ends this first one, but they all end the same way. On being Purana Kasapa, on being asked about the present fruits of the homeless life, explain non-action to me, which is his doctrine, like, you know, wu wei, you know, don't do anything. You know, sort of like Indian form of Taoism, one way of understanding Taoism. Just as if on being asked about a mango, he would describe a breadfruit tree, or on being asked about a breadfruit tree, he would describe a mango. So Purana Kasapa, on being asked about the present fruits of the homeless life, explained non-action to me. And Lord, I thought, how should one like me think despitefully of any ascetic or Brahmin dwelling in my territory? I don't want to be disgusted with him, in other words, because he's a holy person, he's an ascetic. So I neither applauded nor rejected Purana Kasapa's words, but though displeased, not expressing my displeasure, saying nothing, rejecting and scorning speech, I got up and left. So that he repeats this then another five times. And each one gave him a particular theory, and he says, you know, thus he asked about that, but he did it, so I got up and left, you know, and I got up and left, and I got up and left. And he basically, these five, six guys, they have theories of, they're very important all over the literature of the Buddha's biography. And basically, one of them is a fatalist. One of them is an inactivist. One of them is he's a starvationist. And his group didn't last too long. They didn't eat food. One of them is the Jain, kind of nonviolentist and good in some respect, but was actually an indeterminist was what they were philosophically. They wouldn't this way or that way or the other way. You can't say anything. And in that sense, they were. He doesn't like them. The king doesn't. So finally, the Buddha says, "Well, and so, Lord." So he gives us six things that he got up and left, right? And so, Lord, I now ask the Bhagavan, the Blessed Lord, just as there are these various craftsmen, he repeats his original question, and he says, "Can you, Bhagavan, Lord, point to such a reward visible here and now as a fruit of the homeless life?" So now I'm asking you, he says. "Oh, I can, Your Majesty. But I will just ask a few questions in return, and you, sire, answer as you see fit." He again keeps dialoguing with the guy, you see. Because why? Because it's like the Dalai Lama. In his presence, in the Buddha's presence, the most important thing is not what's going on in the Buddha, it's what's going on in the king. So he's trying to draw out the king as much as possible so the king can see what's going on in himself. Do you follow? He's not doing it to play tricks with the king. He's really there with the king. But he knows the king will listen best to himself, actually. So he's letting the king come to the, he's leading the king to the understanding. He is truly a great teacher because he's truly empathetic with his student. And this, he knows this student has a deep disturbance in his heart, of course. He knows that, feels that. So I'll keep asking you, he says, "This is, what do you think, sire? Suppose there were a man, a slave, a laborer, getting up before you and going to bed after you, willingly doing whatever has to be done, well-mannered, pleasant-spoken, working in your presence. And he might think, it is strange, wonderful, the destiny and fruits of meritorious deeds. This king, Ajatasattu Videhiputta of Magadha, is a man, and I too am a man. The king is addicted to and indulges in the fivefold sense pleasures, just like a god, whereas I'm a slave working in his presence. I ought to do something meritorious. Suppose I were to shave off my hair and beard, don yellow robes, actually ochre robes, you know, saffron robes, and go forth from the household life into homelessness, into being a seeker. Suppose I would become a seeker. And before long he does so. And he, having thus gone forth, might dwell restrained in body, speech, and mind, satisfied with a minimum of food and clothing, content in solitude. And then if people were to announce to you, 'Sire, you remember that slave who worked in your presence and who shaved off his hair and beard and went forth into homelessness? He's living restrained in body, speech, and thought in solitude.' Would you then say, 'That man must come back and be a slave and work for me as before?' 'No, indeed, Lord,' says the king, 'for we should pay homage to him. We should rise and invite him and press him to receive from us robes, food, lodging, medicines for sickness and requisites, and make arrangements for his proper protection.' What do you think, sire? Is that one fruit of the seeker's life?" He nails him. Totally. He says, "Visible here and now? Certainly, Lord," he has to admit. "Then that, sire, is the first such fruit of the homeless life." Isn't that amazing? I think it's totally amazing. That's the Dalai Lama for you when you meet the Dalai Lama. Why do you feel special when you meet him? Because you meet someone who's really there for you, rather than has some agenda for you himself. You see, like it's going to give you a theory, like those other five, six people, they wanted to expound and convert the king to their theory. He's not trying to convert the king to anything. He's wanted letting him see and letting him have an answer to the question. But of course, he's going to go on. He says, but then, so then he presses the game, the king does. He says, "But Bhagavan, Lord, can you show any other reward visible here and now as a fruit of the homeless life?" He tries to still be dissatisfied, so he presses. "Oh, I can, sire. But I'll just ask you a few questions in return. And you shall answer as you see fit. What do you think? if you had such and such a person, and he thinks, if they were a man, a farmer, a householder in your service, the steward of an estate, he might think it's strange, wonderful, destiny and fruits of meritorious deeds. This king, Ajatashatru, is a man, and I too am a man. This king is addicted to, you know, that same bunch of sentences. They always abbreviate, you know, the steward of an estate. I ought to do something meritorious. Suppose I were to go forth from the homeless life into homelessness, and before he does so, and he having thus gone forth might dwell. Would you then say, if people were to tell you this, you know, there's a guy who used to run your farm, he went and shaved his hair and beard, went and became a mendicant, and now he lives very nice and peaceful. Would you then say that man must come back and be a steward as before? No, indeed, Lord, for we should pay homage to invite him and blah, 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 and feed him and so on. What do you think, sire? Is that one fruit of the homeless life visible here and now? Certainly, Lord. Then that, sire, is a second such fruit. Again, the king presses. But, Lord, can you show me another reward visible here now as a fruit of the homeless life that's more excellent and perfect than these? I can, sire. And now he's kind of got the king connected enough to him and open enough that he now is going to start teaching himself. He says, I can, sire, and please listen. Your Majesty, pray proper attention, and I will speak. Yes, Lord, said King Ajatashatru, and the Bhagavan went on. So fantastic. Your Majesty, it happens that a Tathagata arises in the world. Tathagata, right, you know that, means one who has gone to suchness. So a transcendent one, one who has transcended the ordinary misperceived universe. Doesn't mean he's left the universe, according to Mahayana. According to the Theravada, maybe they think he left town, but not the case. An arhat, a fully enlightened Buddha, and all these are the standard, you know, epithets of the Buddha, endowed with wisdom and ethics, a blissful one, the knower of the world, incomparable teacher of men to be taught, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. Gods as well as humans, enlightened and blessed. He having realized that by his own super knowledge, that's a kind of higher knowledge, which is super knowledges are clairvoyance, telepathy, some kind of also almost miraculous powers, a knowledge of divine eye and divine ear, ability to hear what people say at a distance and see what they're doing at a distance, five or six of them. Proclaims this world with its gods, devils, and creators, Brahmas, its princes and people, because that's what the people think of Brahma as creator. And the Westerners are so ginger about using the word God. They say Deva, but that means God, simply. Mara means the devil, you know. And people, he preaches, but he's not like a Western devil, but he's more like a celestial Cupid kind of devil. He preaches the Dhamma, that's the teaching, which is, he teaches, they shouldn't say preaches, he teaches the Dhamma, the teaching, which is lovely in the beginning, lovely in its middle, lovely in its ending, and in the spirit and in the letter, and displays the fully perfected and purified holy life. This teaching is heard by a householder or householder's son, one reborn in some family or other. Having heard this teaching, he gains faith in the Tathagata, the transcendent one. Having gained this faith, he reflects, this household life is close and dusty. The homeless life is free as air. It is not easy living the household life. I hate my job, I hate my work, and they took my pension, those corporate raiders. Oh, it's terrible, I have to pay too many taxes. To live the fully perfected holy life, purified and polished like a conch shell is better, you know, they should say. Suppose I were to shave off my hair and beard, don yellow robes, and go forth from the household life into homelessness. And after some time, he abandons his property, small or great, leaves his circle of relatives, goes forth a homeless life. And having gone forth, he dwells, and then perfected in morality, sense towards God, and mindful and aware. And here he doesn't say, would you say this was wrong, because the king has already said several times he wouldn't stop the people doing this. So then he starts to explain, what he had said before about the person. How is he perfected in morality? Well, he abandons the taking of life. He dwells refraining from taking a life, without stick or sword, scrupulous, compassionate, trembling compassionately for the welfare of all beings. Thus he is accomplished in morality, abandoning the taking of what is not given. And then this is annoying. Basically, he goes through the tenfold acts of positive evolutionary action, secular ethics of the taught by the Buddha. And I think actually I will, we still have plenty of time. And Sutta 1, verses 1-8 to 27, where he goes on in full. Maybe I'll go back to that. Hold on to your hats. Okay, because don't be dizzy, don't try to look at it. Here he goes, yeah. Abandoning the taking of life, the ascetic Gotama dwells, refraining from taking of life, without stick or sword, scrupulous, compassionate, trembling for the welfare of all living beings. Thus the worldling would praise the Tathagata, mundane, ordinary, mundane person. Quote, abandoning the taking of what is not given, that's a stealing, right? The ascetic Gotama dwells, refraining from taking what is not given, living purely, accepting what is given, awaiting what is given without stealing, abandoning unchastity. Well, in this case, he's a celibate mendicant. And later this is developed into, you know, you could call it harmful sexuality. It's often translated as adultery, actually, but that's only one harmful thing where one harms a family, you know, through sexuality. But it can be other kinds, you know, rape, any kind of sexual abuse. Using sexuality abusively is what it is, really. In the case of a celibate monk, of course, it is unchastity. But it doesn't necessarily mean unchastity for, like, a married person and so forth, or for an unmarried person who is doing consensual something. Actually, and it's very well, you know, the Buddhist ethics is very, very, it's a secular ethic, it's very elaborated, and it's basically connected to a biological theory, as I said originally, about karma. Those three, killing, stealing, and using sexuality harmfully, harmful sexuality, are the three negative physical things, physical evolutionary acts that through which a person evolves negatively, or devolves, if you call it, but I don't know what word you use for evolves negatively, but evolves negatively, becoming in the special sense of the Buddha's secular ethic, where the reason for ethics is to advance to humanity, and then beyond humanity to advance to enlightenment. That's the purpose of ethics. That's the purpose of evolution. There is a goal you can adopt yourself for your own evolution, which is to be perfectly free of suffering, perfectly happy, perfectly unharmful to anybody else, and, you know, blissful. That's the purpose of life, actually. In a long evolutionary sense, that's what all beings are trying to find. In Buddha's secular scientific vision of biology. And those three things are ways of separating yourself from life. Because you separate yourself from another life by killing. You separate by killing another being. You separate yourself from another life by taking their property, which diminishes their sense of being. But also in the time when, as a mammal, who's able to consciously kind of like choose paths of behavior, sexuality is a time when you can kind of melt your boundary of I'm different from you, and you can kind of empathize completely with the beloved in truly loving sexuality, and using that harmfully to just an object, and harming that object through it out of some sense of your separate egotistical pleasure, is like spoiling the most important moment when you could get an evolutionary grasp of non-duality with others, of self and other, if you follow me. So it's equally actually bad. It's like killing and taking what is not given, you know, harmful sexuality. So these are not, these are not said, well, if you do this, Buddha will punish you or send you to hell, or God will punish you. They don't say that. They say that you will evolve negatively. And the opposites are also taught. If you save lives, you save a life and you identify with the other life. So therefore, you will expand your sense of life. You will, at least intuitively identifying with the other life, you will feel connected to their life. You give them something and expand their sense of ownership and being. And then you are, in that way, you identify with them owning this thing that you gave them. And you use sexuality only beneficially, And then you learn what that means to be more than yourself, to let go of yourself, to give yourself to another being. So it's a very deep, it can be a very deep, positive evolutionary act, if you follow me. Again, not rewarded by God, not a religious ethics, not rewarded by the Pope, by authority, by Buddha. No, they can reward or punish. But, you know, the action is its own reward or punishment in the sense that it has an evolutionary effect. Do you follow? It's so beautiful. Original secular ethics. Then there's four of speech. Abandoning false speech. The ascetic Gotama dwells refraining from false speech. A truth speaker, one to be relied upon, trustworthy, dependable, not a deceiver of the world. Abandoning malicious speech, he does not repeat there what he has heard to the detriment of these, or repeat here what he has heard there to the detriment of those. Backbiting, you know, in other words, thus he is a reconciler of those at variance and an encourager of those at one, rejoicing in peace, loving it, delighting in it, one who speaks up for peace. So not a backbiter, but a peacemaker. Not a liar, but a truth teller. Abandoning harsh speech, he refrains from it. He speaks whatever is blameless, pleasing to the ear, agreeable, reaching the heart, urbane, pleasing and attractive to the multitude. Like, ideally, he would be a singer, folk singer. He would give his teaching singing. Reach the heart of the, like Bob Dylan or something, reach the heart of the audience. Abandoning idle chatter, that would be the sweetest speech, in other words, would be like musical speech. Abandoning idle chatter, you know, I've had many papers over the years from students comparing these to the Ten Commandments, which then is religious ethics. And some Buddhists will think this is Buddhist ethics, but if they think about it, religious ethics too, but if they think about it, it isn't, because you're not being told that this is what the authority says you have to do and they'll punish you if you don't. So it's religion enforces this, not at all. But you're doing it to yourself. You killed somebody, you're going to die by the sword, you know. Live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. They're teaching like that. They're putting the burden on the person, you know, in a science, based on the science of their biology and their evolutionary, the fact that they are evolutionary beings in a nexus of relativity. Sorry. Thus the worldling would praise the Gotama. So, well, now he goes into kind of lay ethics in this particular version. And, you know, he goes into what monastic, you know, what seekers do, you know, like ascetics, shamanas, you know. So they don't eat at night, they don't go to shows, they don't dress up and put on makeup, they don't use high beds, they don't touch money, they don't accept raw grain, they don't accept gifts of women and young girls, male or female slaves, sheep and goats, cocks and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, fields and plots like property, which this was that ancient society. He's not saying there's anything good about it, just saying they would not do that. He refrains from running errands, from buying and selling, from cheating with false weights and measures, from bribery and corruption, deception and sincerity, wounding, killing, imprisoning, highway robbery, and taking food by force. That's the world and praise the Tathagata. So those are more social things. And, you know, this actually shows bad things that some of the fake seekers do. You know, they use their sort of holiness to grab stuff. He tells the king, this is all repeated in the later sutra that we're reading. And he's not doing the mental ones, I think, because then he says, you know, whereas some ascetics and Brahmins, you know, that is, seekers and priests remain addicted to disputations such as, you don't understand this doctrine and discipline, I do. How could you understand this doctrine and discipline? Your way is all wrong, mine is right. I'm consistent, you aren't. You said last what you have said first, first what you have last. In other words, they don't try to dominate people with speech. Buddhists don't. And they don't run errands. He's elaborating what all those things are. He's challenging, actually, the bad ethics of religious ascetics, you know, holy people. Bad behavior of holy men. And I just was wanting to see if he had the mental ethic, because the mental ethic, so now he goes into, in a way he does, because the three negative mental ones in the tenfold path of reaction are greed, greedy mind, malicious mind, and deluded mind. And then he goes into, of course, a long thing about wrong worldviews or deluded worldviews of different kinds. Amazing long thing about that. So, okay, back to our sutra.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about the music of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. Study Buddhism up close and personal with Robert Thurman during upcoming Tibet House U.S. trips with Geographic Expeditions. Trips in 2018 include Mongolia and Bhutan. To learn about these Tibet House member trips and the benefits of becoming a monthly supporter, please visit tibethouse.us. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Dalek.